Welcome back to the slideshow. It's I'm Dakota Jackson. I got my master's degree in jazz studies. I'm a trombonist here in New Orleans, and at the moment, video game tester. And I got my co-host Ben with me.
Hi guys, I'm Benjamin Wiltz. I am a band director up here at Mammoth Spring, Arkansas. I'm also a fly fishing guide and a grad school dropout.
Yeah, it's definitely been a minute since we've been on the podcast. I know that personally, one of the reasons that we decided to come back was because it's just been popping up in my life a lot. Like, it's crazy how many of you all listen. Like, first of all, like, not even making this up. I thought we'd never have more than 10 fans, and like three of those being my mom listening on different devices. So, you know, it means so much that you guys are there. And so you're honestly the reason we're back. But yeah, I've just been having a hankering to do this, to get back into some research, to talk some trombone. And I've had people come up to me in my personal life about it. And I know that like Ben's had it pop up in his life too, man. Like, what about you, Ben? How's your week been?
I mean, it's been good. I did hear I had some students listening to this. So I guess we will try to keep it family friendly. But, man, my life's been good recently. Up here in North Arkansas, we've had some nice winter weather, and so it's looking like I might have even a week off of school this upcoming week. It looks like we're going to have a pretty heavy snow next couple days, so I will have plenty of time. And I actually brought my trombone home with me in preparation for it, so I'm gearing up for a good week.
Yeah, Man, we don't get any snow here in New Orleans. Yeah, but it gets a little cold, you know, but it's okay because I'm able to be warmed up by this delicious Magner cider. Magner cider is, they've been making this cider since 1935, and they reckon there's only one way to do it. And that's by taking inspiration from the ways they've done it for years, using 17 varieties of apple. I mean, that's how they get the classic Magner's taste. And, we're looking for endorsements right now, if anyone's interested out there and hitting up the pod.
Hey, for what it's worth, I will say that the people at Rocktown Distillery who made this bourbon that I'm drinking at the moment did, in fact, hire both me and Cody. And so they do support the trombone industry in one way or another.
That's true. We have had owners do that. at a church gig, I might add.
All right, man. Well, I guess we'll just go ahead and start out. We hadn't had a trombone in the news segment in a while since we've been away. And I guess what I was, this is about a month old, this news that I found, but it's actually an article about a robot trombone player. And it's pretty funny, actually. So this guy, his name is Sax Laboratories, which is a YouTube channel. They managed to create a trombone playing robot that uses air pressure gauges to simulate a actual trombone player. They call it Robo Trombo. And while this sounds very exciting and also nerve wracking to people like Cody who try to make their living off of playing the trombone, I think our jobs are safe at the moment because, I highly suggest any of you guys to look up Robo Trombo at home and listen to it. It is pretty funny, but also kind of neat. Somebody's put the time in for this. I guess this is what happens whenever you have a year worth of pandemic to stay at home and work on. So yeah, I highly suggest you guys look up this video. The guy actually shows the robot playing the trombone, but also does a walkthrough and kind of shows how it's made. They use like silicone lips, kind of a neat thing, but also shows that like the human factor is like really important whenever you're playing a wind instrument, specifically brass.
Yeah, it does. It sounds pretty comical at this point. I will say though, if you guys aren't hip to this, there's a video on the internet of a robot playing John Coltrane's Giant Steps with his solo, and it's like crazy. It's perfect. It's like super fast and stuff, and very robotic, if you can believe that.
What was this on? Was this on saxophone?
Yeah, it was on saxophone. Oh, yeah. It's a robot saxophone. It didn't sound that bad either. I don't know what that says about the saxophone.
Yeah, I think the evidence is clear, but we can move.
All right. So this week's topic is going to be mouthpieces. I thought we'd give you guys a little gear since that seems to be what everyone likes. I'm still going to do the other stuff, obviously, but we'll come back with some gear. And I'm not going to lie to anybody. Mouthpieces was a pretty overwhelming topic for me personally, because I'm a little bit of a gearhead, but definitely when it comes to mouthpieces, I'm not insanely knowledgeable. So it was a lot of research. But I think it's a cool topic, and I think there's a lot of different angles and stuff to talk about. And I'm kind of excited about digging into it. I know Ben kind of feels similarly when it comes to like not being an expert on it. I will, before we get into this, we'll talk about my personal setups, but just to remove any bias so you guys know what I play on, and I'm not endorsed, unfortunately. Although if anyone's interested, I'm down to pay less. I play a Pickett 6M with a gold rim on my Gessen, my jazz horn, and on my BAC, I'm just playing on like a Schulke 51D at the moment.
Yeah, and I, Cody, I play on a Schulke 60 that I went ahead and did some research on to figure out when I bought this thing. I bought it 7 years ago. Actually, no, I'm sorry, 8 years ago, since it's 2021. And on my bass trombone and then on my jazz horn, I play, or my small tenor, I play an 11C, a Bach 11C. And yeah, I've played both of those mouthpieces for quite some time. And really, that's the only two that I use.
Yeah, man. I mean, and we'll get into this. I think this is going to start off with like different philosophies, but some people use a lot of different mouthpieces. And like Ben, as somebody who moves around from the bass trombone to the to the trigger, you know, concert horn, big horn, whatever you call it, to the to a jazz horn, you change around a lot, man?
Well, I do change mouthpieces whenever I go from, let's say, a bass trombone to a concert tenor, even though both of them accept a large shank mouthpiece. You do get a bit of a darker sound from a traditional bass trombone mouthpiece, but I try to keep everything as close as I can. I didn't even mention me using the 2G on a concert tenor, which I hope any tenor trombonist listening to this would say, dude, that's way too big. I honestly am just trying to play on whatever's as comfortable as possible while still sounding like a tenor trombone. The Schulke 60 used in a concert tenor would not sound good, or it would sound more like a bass trombone anyways. And then, yeah, switching to an 11C on the tenor, the jazz horn, to be honest, that was the mouthpiece I had. That doesn't sound like I did a lot of research in it, but I just kind of grabbed the mouthpiece. At the time I didn't play the small bore tenor enough to constitute me spending the money on it, and just played on the same mouthpiece for a little bit on it. So I noticed some differences. I mean, there's going to be some big differences between them, but I mean, I just didn't see a big reason for us to for me to stay on that, or to really investigate, I guess, into different sizing.
Yeah, man, I know that there's people who and I think Jay Friedman is one of these guys. Hopefully I'm not wrong in saying this, but I'm pretty sure I saw him kind of be into this. It's like, there's people who have like mouthpieces, not just for different horns, but for like different situations. Like a lot of people in the classical world, you'll hear like the bolero mouthpiece, like this mouthpiece that they pull out for playing high. I will say, like, in the trumpet community, this is way more rampant. Like there's definitely trumpet players who like walk around with like a mini bag of mouthpieces that they, I'm playing the third book today, or I'm playing the second book, or I'm playing lead, so I gotta do this. And so it's not that crazy in the trombone world, but there definitely is people who are into like switching around a ton for different like situations.
Yeah, man. I played in a community orchestra with a guy, oddly enough, from Chicago, so I think there might have been a Jay Friedman influence, if what you said was true. But this guy had three mouthpieces, and he actually had them color-coded, and he kept them on a rag that he had next to his seat. And depending on the section of music he was playing, he would switch between these mouthpieces. So he definitely had a different mouthpiece philosophy than the other people in the trombone section. And it's not that he was a bad player, but he definitely had a different approach to the horn, you can tell. And I don't know. I thought it was interesting. It's the first time I'd seen something like that.
Yeah. You know, we'll like get into this. We're definitely going to get into like a lot of the tech kind of end of it. I'm not to say tech, but like the hardware side of it, like where there's like this like materials and stuff. But I think that philosophies have also kind of evolved because one of the things is, you know, I know Curtis Fuller used to play on a King 28, and then I'm not sure what Frank Rosalino played on, but both of those dudes played like the same mouthpiece like their entire life. It's very likely that that was like the first mouthpiece that like Curtis got, and he just kept playing on it, or whatever he bought his 3B that he played on Blue Train, for example, that he just played throughout. And like kind of the same thing with Frank, and it's like crazy to think about, you know, I'm not near as good as Curtis or Frank, but even I have like upgraded mouthpieces, you know. I feel like, oh, I gotta spend X amount of money to like get into this like nice mouthpiece range. And but yeah, I think, you know, I mean, A, that obviously speaks to like, I think that speaks to a couple of things. One of the things it speaks to is like that you can sound great on whatever if you like just shit, you know. I mean, like I used to kind of believe that, and then I saw Jigswig, I'm like, rip a Frank Rosalino solo on a P-Bone, and like that moment changed my life. Like then I was like, oh no, like all my gearhead stuff is just BS. Like the truth is that like I just need to shed more. but on the flip side of that, like I think the other thing it shows is that comfort is like a huge factor. Just in like it's not everything, and I think that there's like this is a huge argument too. I know all there's just so many philosophies with mouthpieces. There's another reason why I was tentative to do the episode, is because it's like I have some thoughts, but I know that some people have extremely strong thoughts, and I wouldn't argue with any of them. I don't feel strong enough to do that.
Absolutely, man. I actually subscribe a lot to the comfort argument. I had been getting mixed messages between two instructors that I was actually taking from. And I was moving between two mouthpieces. I can't even remember the specifics between them, but actually one of the mouthpieces was a Schottky 60 like I'm playing on now. And I remember I had actually taken a hiatus from playing on that Schottky 60 for quite some time. I remember I went back to it and I was like, wow, this is extremely comfortable. I was originally a tuba player. Please guys, don't attack me for that. I did see the light, you know, and switched to trombone. But yeah, so I was originally a tuba player, so I did play on a slightly larger mouthpiece than you saw a lot of trombone players playing on. And whenever I came to the Schottky 60, came back to it, I finally had like a lesson teacher say, wow, you sound really good on that. And to be honest, like, or you sound, your tone was sounded the most comfortable. He said the word comfortable when he was referring to my tone. And I was like, wow, like, you know, I really think all of that probably had to do with my head more than anything else. There was nothing wrong with either mouthpiece I was using. It was really just my approach to it. And it probably didn't have to do anything with the physicality of it. It was the fact that I played on the same mouthpiece over and over. And this is once again, just my philosophy. And it's in no way gospel or anything that should be treated as a science or held in any regard as to that of higher level players, even Cody.
Yeah, I mean, as I've already stated, I don't really feel like my opinion is all that much. I will say that I also kind of subscribe to the comfort thing. It's like, if something feels good, you know, and like one thought I had whenever I was selecting my mouthpiece, just to talk about my personal experience, is that like, I was like, wow, I'm going to play on this every day. I think about this with my horns too. I don't know how you guys feel about this, and if you don't agree with this, that's cool, but I think about with all my gear, like I'm gonna play on this every day, so if it feels better, or even if it makes me in my mind, like even if it doesn't actually sound better, even if mentally I'm like, boy, I like this a little bit more, that's gonna make my entire life better, because I play trombone every single day. And so I kind of feel like from that angle, but I will say once again, because in fairness, I'm just trying to bring out both philosophies and not go super hardcore or anything. The other idea is kind of like anatomy is a factor that like you can kind of like gauge off how your mouth is, like what you should be playing on. And also like you'll adapt to whatever you play. So like you'll pick up something that'll like is what you kind of should do. And then after a certain amount of time, it'll start feeling more natural.
Yeah, man, on that note, I actually sat there. I went to the 2014 ITF. If you remember that too, that was probably the greatest experience in my trombone life. If, in case you guys didn't know, International Trombone Festival. And I went there being the young player I was. And I said, I'm getting a mouthpiece from this. Now, spoiler alert, I did not leave this festival with a mouthpiece. I went to a very popular mouthpiece maker. Will not say their name. And they looked at my face and said, I went and said, I want a rim of a Schottky 60 with a shallow cup. Because I had heard, apparently, and once again, I was a young player subscribing to other people's mouthpiece philosophies, that that would be the ideal mouthpiece choice for me to play on a large bore tenor trombone. So I said I wanted a Schottky 60 rim with a shallower cup. Anyways, he told me, he looked at my face and said, you are not ready for a Schottky 60 before me playing the horn. And then after that, I was like, wow, that was a really strong stance. And really threw me off. But also looking back now, it really shows like these people are very sunk into their own mouthpiece philosophies. And this person, I wouldn't say to this day that he has a bad mouthpiece philosophy, because he does, in fact, play trombone very well. And also has quite the following. So I wouldn't say he was wrong. He was just sticking to what he was used to teaching. And I don't blame him for that. But I didn't necessarily change mouthpieces right off the bat from that. It really was kind of an interesting experience to see, because that contradicted both the teacher's point of view along with other points of view that I was reading. And I realized that even people at the top level had such differing points of view on this subject, that it wasn't going to be a black and white issue. And it really was a awakening moment for me on the mouthpiece topic.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that, man. That same exact event at 2014 ITF, I had played on a mouthpiece that I liked, and I had some thoughts about people who played them. And I was going to go buy mouthpiece X at this festival, and like, you guys don't even understand how set I had saved money to buy it. I was ready to drop cash right there. I knew I wanted it. It was like in the conversation. This wasn't even an issue. Like, I was going to check things out. I was just like, this is what I want. I even knew what I wanted. And I'm not gonna go into it too deep, but like, I just got there and it was like kind of not what I was expecting. And so then I was like, well, maybe I'm not gonna drop this money. And then as I'm walking around that same sales floor with like mouthpieces and stuff everywhere, I'm kind of looking at some different things. That was where I first even like knew that Pickett exists, which I don't think they were a small company. They already had Wycliffe Gordon as an artist at that point. So they were definitely established. It was just me not being on the mouthpiece radar in general, because I was like a college freshman at the time. But yeah, so I grabbed like I tried one of them out and I was like, man, I really like this. And then I tried out like a rounded and flat rim, and we'll get into that too. But I liked the flat rim and I liked the gold, and I didn't even have enough money for the gold with the normal rim. So I got a 2-piece silver, and then a couple months later I bought a gold rim. And since then, I had like an issue with my mouthpiece, and at this point, like, I'm in the never change zone of my life. So I just bought the exact same cup, but with like a different one. So I don't know, if you're a mouthpiece seller out there, I'll give you this bit of advice. Like, whenever someone tries out your stuff, just try and sell it to them. I know that sounds crazy, but I think that's like a good bit of advice. Like, if they dig it, be like, yeah, man. And then like, why question it further? I mean, if it's selling anything, that seems to be logical, but yeah, you know?
Absolutely, man. I did not end up buying a mouthpiece during that ITF. I actually, I went with what my lessons teacher told me afterwards, and spent a lot of money on literature. I spent about what I was going to pay on a mouthpiece just on buying solos and things like that. And I think that was a good investment. But yeah, a mouthpiece maker could have got a decent amount of money on. I went ready to buy, you know, just because I had a differing philosophy from him. Now, I'm not going to say I was smarter than the guy. Dear Lord, I was a sophomore in college, and I did not know half as much as he did. But I did have an idea, and I was guided to that decision that I had come to before that. But yeah, and I think that really shows that, like, these, we really do have these philosophies that are strikingly different, but I mean, we come to a pretty similar result. Like Curtis Fuller, like you said, had the same mouthpiece all the way through, at least as far as we could tell. I mean, maybe he had a different mouthpiece. I think like what you said, I bet you that king that he had came with that 3B. He probably played the mouthpiece that came with the horn. I think we'd be remiss to not mention the trombone chat in this conversation, because something that I see come up on there a lot is you should play the mouthpiece that sounds best with a certain horn. A lot of people believe certain mouthpieces sound better with certain horns. And I think there could be like some legitimate thought to that. I haven't tried certain mouthpieces with certain horns to the point where I just get, where I record myself and just think that I play that same horn or that one mouthpiece with that one horn over and over, especially if they're both a tenor and or both a bass, whatever. But I think these guys are approaching it with a logical mindset to it. I can see where they come from, but that's just not necessarily how I go. I usually just stick with what I'm most comfortable with. But yeah, I mean, it is just a piece of metal. And for the most part, at this point, I think these companies have it dialed in. And usually what's comfortable works, at least based on my experience.
Yeah, one thing I will say, you know, it's funny you bring up Curtis, because I actually played a King 28. You guys know I'm like a huge Curtis fan. And one of the things I love is like his super dark, huge sound. And when I first played a King 28, man, it was so small. It's like a really tiny mouthpiece. And I was like, it just blew my mind. But then I think that like also kind of talks about like what you're familiar with is a huge thing. I mean, in terms of range or anything, like my mouthpiece may not be the best thing for playing high notes, but I feel like if I switched to a mouthpiece that was more set up for playing high notes through whatever means, I would either come to the same range, or even if I got slightly better, it wouldn't be a lot, because I feel like, you know, like what you're familiar with and what your tone concept is of building is like a big thing. I mean, I feel like, I don't know, maybe that's like anti-switching, but I do feel like, yeah, like what you get comfortable with is like what you're going to be able to develop your sound concept on over time.
All right. This is going to really cause some controversy, but I can play just as high on my Schottky 60 as I can on my Bach 11C. The difference is going to be the tone quality. Needless to say, on the Schottky 60 with a much, much larger rim, the high notes are going to be a little bit squirrelier. But yeah, I am, because like you said, I've played on the Schottky 60 for I don't know how many hundreds of times more than I've played on that 11C. I'm much more comfortable on it. And those high notes do come out. And so I do think you have a good point there that, yeah, what you're comfortable with and what you do really makes a big difference. And I think it's kind of unfair to the people who switch mouthpieces, because I don't want to delegitimize those people. But I think it's kind of unfair that Cody and I both are in the same camp on this one, because probably because I don't necessarily have the money to be switching mouthpieces all the time.
I mean, that's a huge factor, man. That's a factor for me. And that was no doubt a factor for somebody like Curtis when he started out, you know, like trying to feed himself in New York City. I'm sure it was not like the easiest thing either. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that dictated the rest of his life or whatever, but yeah, there's definitely, for beginners, it's hard to ask your mom like, hey, you know, I just got $130 professional mouthpiece, but you know, I have some higher passages coming up in wind ensemble, and it'd be really killer if I had another $130 mouthpiece. I mean, good luck with that, you know. I mean, if that's working for you, killer. But it's just like, that's definitely a factor, like what you can get your hands on.
We just lost every trumpet player that's listening to the podcast.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's a very small audience, I feel like. I will say, trumpet players, if you want a little shout out, when I was doing research on this, you guys have a lot of opinions. I definitely ended up on the Trumpet Herald a lot. You know, trumpet players, they switch way more. They really like, they're mouthpiece crazy. I don't know. Like it's a thing in the trombone world, but nothing like the trumpet world, or even in the saxophone world for that matter. You know what I mean? Like I know several saxophone players who have several mouthpieces sitting in their cases. And me and Ben were just talking about how trombone cases come with 2 to 3 slots for your mouthpieces, and like you really just put one in there. I mean, I the only time I've used the second one was for a backup mouthpiece in case I was like an idiot and forgot my mouthpiece, which has happened, by the way. That's happened at a game. I'm not gonna try and pretend to be some holier than thou. I have done that like a moron. I mean, I was young and dumb, but it definitely, you know. So there you go. There's my pro tip of the day. If you're wondering why you got the second holder, it's so you can put a backup for when you're an idiot and leave your mouthpiece behind.
Well, it seems like a strong stance was taken on this. I will say, like, looking at saxophones from a band director standpoint, I could see a use for a saxophone player to have like a rubber mouthpiece and maybe a metal mouthpiece in their case. But yeah, I learned about the whole mouthpiece switching philosophy from a trumpet player when I was in high school. I was a tuba player, and actually I grabbed whatever mouthpiece I could. I had a Con Helleberg 7B until I lost it at a marching band event, and then I just got the cheapest mouthpiece they had at the local music store. It was like a 24AW or whatever, probably in ninth grade or whatever. I couldn't tell you much of a difference on a tuba. Now, maybe some tuba players are triggered by that. But at the time, yeah, it wasn't a huge difference. If I played, I guess now, maybe it would be. But yeah, I mean, it was kind of whatever at the time. And I think that's easy to overlook, is that back in the day, it was a little bit harder to get a hold of certain mouthpieces. You didn't have these big festivals where you got to try out 1,000 mouthpieces. Do you think Curtis Fuller got to go to a picket stand and try out 3 or 4 different rim sizes and cup sizes and shank sizes before he landed on one? Probably not. So probably he just played on the same thing because it's what he knew, and anything else he had to order was in a catalog. And ordering from a catalog didn't help much when you didn't know how it sounded or how it felt or how comfortable something was.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm really about to get out of my depths when it comes to knowledge. So forgive me if this is completely wrong, but I honestly kind of feel like the whole like mouthpiece companies in general being a thing where it was just like just a mouthpiece company is kind of a relatively new idea. I feel like for a long time, like mouthpieces were largely made by instrument makers. You know, like it was like Bach had mouthpieces and Kahn had mouthpieces. I mean, like J.J. Johnson plays on a Kahn M8, you know, or he did for some time. I guess he probably switched around a little bit, but you know, or Olds made mouthpieces, or King or whoever. But it was like companies like Monet and Pickett and Warbenite and or it's
Warburton.
Warbenite is the material that they make their alternative out of. It's like a rubber material. But yeah, like these companies, I don't think were as prevalent, at least. They may have been around, but I don't think there was as many of them for sure. I think the machinery getting better has definitely helped the mouthpiece thing, because it is a lot of precision for sure.
Absolutely, man. And when we talk about philosophies, I do want to mention there are some different views. One that I've heard was that you should play on the biggest mouthpiece that you can handle. And I guess what that means is, I guess, play on the biggest mouthpiece that you can play the music that you're given. That seems very vague, because you're dealing with rim diameter and cup depth and all these other things. But yeah, that was definitely an old school philosophy, that this idea that, yeah, hey, if the highest thing you ever have to play is a B flat above the bass clef, then you need to be playing the biggest mouthpiece that you can still have that note readily available. I think that's a little bit too generalizing, because there are lots of situations where you may need to do other things. And there's actually a complete opposite camp, that is, you should play the smallest thing that you can play. But I don't know. I think it definitely varies from person to person. And I think that's why that comfort philosophy is where I usually fall, because it's not necessarily that a Schilke 60 is going to be the biggest thing that I could handle. I don't know if I could handle something bigger. I honestly wouldn't try something bigger. I do know that if I tried something smaller, that it would take a lot of adjusting to. And I don't know if that adjusting with my level of playing, especially being a teacher and not necessarily playing every single day, I don't know if that adjustment that I would need to make to a smaller mouthpiece would be worth it. I think that I would have to overcome a lot of problems from adjusting in order to see the benefits from switching to a smaller mouthpiece.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, this once again, mouthpieces are overwhelming because there is like so many things. I'll say when I was researching this, I found new things. I mean, I'm not saying I'm an expert on the trombone, but I know a lot about the trombone and I spent too much time on the internet looking at trombone stuff. And whenever I went to research this stuff, I still found new stuff. I found out that some people boil their mouthpieces. Like, well, I have no idea. I've never even thought to boil my mouthpiece. Maybe that is a superior method. I have no thoughts on that. I'm just saying that that's a thing in the world, you know? And another, like I honestly hadn't even thought about this till recently, and I guess this makes a lot of sense, is like a lot of people when they put their mouthpiece in, they rotate it till they find like they have the sweet spot. Like, I guess some people call it clocking. I've been having conversations about this, but like John Fedchuk doesn't. All right, and I don't sound near as good as John Fedchuk, so it's something I'm gonna at least look into. So I think, like, in general, you know, just check it out. And but with all that being said, with all that being saying this, like, oh, go do all this research and all this crazy stuff. I had a trombone teacher who was an incredible player, who was the principal in the Arkansas Symphony, and he got a new mouthpiece. And the only reason that he got a new Griego mouthpiece, which was the old one that he had, is because the old one was turning black. All right. So yeah, there's definitely, like, if it's working and if it's, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. If you like that, go with that.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the clocking thing, because I remember at ITF 2014, again, I had a guy at the Yamaha stand. I'll say this because I do play on the Yamaha trombone to this day. I had a guy at the Yamaha stand sitting there telling me that cryogenically freezing your trombone makes a difference in the sound it makes. And I honestly thought it was kind of a marketing gimmick. And this guy, in order to prove his point, didn't throw me on a cryogenically frozen trombone. Instead, he said, hey, man, what mouthpiece you got in your pocket? So I pulled out my Schilke 60, and he said, all right, I want you to play it with the word Schilke at 12 o'clock. And then we did 12 o'clock, and he said, all right, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock. We did the whole thing. And I ended up coming at, I think it was 9 o'clock. Still to this day, after that one moment, I put my Schilke at 9 o'clock. And I was like, well, I guess that felt a little bit better. I don't know if I was just in the moment at the time this guy told me that, or if that honestly felt better. But the placebo effect is a real thing. And I guess I was in my head enough that my Schilke is always facing 9 o'clock when I put my when I put my mouthpiece in my horn. I don't know if I've ever even told Cody that, so I'm sure he's probably think something weird about me now. But I sure
I mean, dude, John Fedchuk does it, so it's approved. I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, I've been thinking about doing it myself. I will say that when I got my BAC, like, Mike Corrigan's kind of anti-removable lead pipes, and the main reason is he feels like there's a sweet spot on the lead pipe in terms of rotation. So when I picked up the horn, we moved it around a couple. Ben was there for this. We moved it around to a couple different angles till we found the one that I liked the most, and then he soldered it in. So yeah, I guess mouthpieces could work the same way. If you disagree with this strongly, I am not going to fight you. That's one thing with this whole thing. I do want to know everyone's opinions, man. Please, like, let me know your thoughts. Like, let me know if you do something wild that you think that everyone else doesn't do. Certainly let me know that. But if you want to have an argument with me, like, just know that I don't have enough knowledge to fight you. And I'll let you win. If you feel strongly enough about it, whatever, you know. And speaking of giant arguments, this next thing we're gonna do, speaking of philosophy and arguments, and I think I'm gonna go out of the way and not even tell you my personal preference on this. Let's talk about mouthpiece buzzing, because there is some different thoughts. All right, like, it's not universal at all. Let's just start with, like, we'll start with personal experience a little bit, because I need to talk about like beginners and, you know, school and stuff. So Ben, like, what about you? Like, what was your first introduction to mouthpiece buzzing? I mean, because I know some people, I think this happened with me too. I buzzed a mouthpiece before I even played a trombone. I mean, that's a thing. So, so what about you, Ben? Like, what's your personal history been like with mouthpiece buzzing?
So I did start off on tuba, and I think tuba is a little bit different than trombone when it comes to buzzing, because it is a completely different technique, just because of how low the instrument is. However, we did have to buzz whenever I was in school. Our band director was very adamant about buzzing. In fact, we played this song called The Dragonfly in sixth grade, where at one point in the middle of the song, all of the brass instruments had to take their mouthpiece out of their instrument and buzz. So I think that really speaks for itself on where my sixth grade band program, whenever I was in it, stood on buzzing. So we did a lot of buzzing work. And even all the way up until my college years, I remember every lesson I had to do something called a mouthpiece tune, where I'd pick some folk song or some nursery rhyme or something like that and actually buzz it on my mouthpiece. So I had pretty much my teachers that I had throughout school were big advocates for buzzing. So I kind of carried that on, me being a band director, I've carried that on, but I have seen some of the merits of some of the arguments against it, but I think it does have some value beyond necessarily what your lips do. And we can talk about that in a bit.
So now that I got Ben to spill the beans on his personal history, I won't even talk about mine. I'll just open up with this. In 2015, Christian Lemberg made a video on YouTube. And I remember I was like really heavy into, I was going to say trombone chat, but back then it was the trombone forum. The trombone chat is the new trombone forum. Trombone chat's better.
Yeah.
But it's just upsetting that the trombone forum wasn't better upkept by the people who had the domain. But there was like this video by Christian Lindbergh that was incredibly anti-buzzing. And I've seen him restate this before a couple different times, where he said like he doesn't believe in buzzing. And in the video, because I just recently revisited it, he plays a note and he's like, hear how that sounds? And then he buzzes a note and then he shoves the horn on the mouthpiece. And it sounds awful. And he's like, doesn't that sound horrendous? And then he starts playing a beautiful note again. And then I have a lot of thoughts on this personally. But then he takes the mouthpiece off. He takes the horn off of the mouthpiece. And he's just blowing air. And one thing I'll say about that is like, I'm not saying that Christian doesn't actually. I know he doesn't buzz in his practice. And I don't know, I'm not going to make any assumptions about the physics of him playing, but I will say, if you try and play a note and take the horn off the mouthpiece, good luck trying to do that and not take the mouthpiece off your face, unless you're just like ramming it into your face. It's kind of hard to do, but he's like an anti-buzzer. He's like super against it because he says that's like not how you make sound. And I've heard a lot of people say that. And then, so the forum was blowing up with all these people who were like, oh, wow, you know, I've been buzzing this whole time. I buzz. I can't believe I buzz. And it got to be a big deal. And then Ben Van Dyke, who is this incredible bass trombonist, who, if you don't know Ben Van Dyke, he's like on the, in my mind, the Mount Rushmore of bass trombonists. But but he just like released a video where he's buzzing. Like, I can't remember what it was. It was like an orchestral excerpt or something. And then he just puts the horn on and he's playing and it's gorgeous. And he just like shrugs and it just says, works for me on the screen.
There's trombone diss track.
So there's different opinions from like the pros. And I'll say that there's also a lot of gray in there. Like, I know that Nick Finzer is like, I don't think he buzzes, but he sees like the value in it. And that's like kind of where I'm at. I will say that I try to, and I can't actually do this on my new horn, and this is probably awful. Like, people who really care about gear are going to hate this. But for a little bit, I was sticking like a paper clip in like the mouthpiece receiver while I put that in there. And then like just forcing myself to be accurate on pitches like that. But my most recent teacher was like a fan of buzzing, but he was a fan of buzzing with reference. So like buzzing, but not going too long without playing your horn. So there is definitely a ton of gray. I will say that from a musical standpoint, I think it's really good because it like helps with pitch. You know, you're like, you have to come up with the pitches on your own and you're locking them in. But I can see how people think that personally, this is one of those things where you got to investigate on your own, but I feel like the tone I'm getting with my mouthpiece or the buzzing I'm doing with my mouthpiece, like isn't necessarily what's happening when I'm just trying to get great tone with my trombone. And I don't even know why I didn't think to say this, but going the complete, like, real, if you really want to get into buzzing, Toby Oft is a huge fan, and I've done this, of just using a rim. All right. So he doesn't even use the cup. So if you want to talk about like the horn being an amplifier or whatever, he's got no amplification. He's just got the rim. And I mean, even past that, people are into free buzzing, which is just buzzing without the mouthpiece. So there's, needless to say, a huge wide array of thoughts on it.
Yeah, man. So when you mentioned the paperclip technique, I will say as a band director, it's really hard to pinpoint whether or not certain student success is due to things like buzzing versus natural ability versus just constant practice. However, in just anecdotal evidence, I can tell you for a fact that the kids that I've had who have implemented things like the paperclip technique and have constantly buzzed the songs that they intended to play have done well. And I think that that's for a multitude of reasons. I don't know if necessarily it's the actual movement of your lips. I don't think your lips are just building up this muscle memory, but I think a lot of it has to do with this idea that it's making sure that you know the song you're going to play before you play it. A lot of times as trombonists, you can cheat with your instrument because it does in fact tend to lean towards the notes that you're going to play based on the position that you put your instrument in. And so I think that's where buzzing does have an effect because it keeps you honest on whether or not you actually know the song. If you record yourself buzzing and what you play does not sound, or what you hear does not sound like the song you're trying to play, then when you put your horn on it, it's not going to be that great because you don't know the song that well. And I think you're going to have some issues transitioning between partials. I could be wrong on that. This is, once again, just anecdotal evidence. And I guess your mileage may vary, but I honestly think that's been my whole take on this whole buzzing ordeal, is because I just see these kids who can't buzz a song and then they struggle, especially changing partials. And I think that has a lot to do with lip flexibility, is that they're not necessarily buzzing directly on the note and they're needing a lot of help from their horn. I don't know how you feel on that, but that's just something that I've seen. And this goes for trumpet players as well, but especially some of my best buzzers tend to be trumpet players. I don't know why, but it just comes to my head immediately that I have these trumpet players who are just buzzing the tune immediately. And so I've seen a lot of results with mouthpiece buzzing. But once again, I'm not necessarily knocking these pro musicians, that, especially Christian Lindbergh, these people who are at the top level. But, you know, hey, I'm a bass trombonist. You know, if I had to pick sides, I am a Ben Van Dyke fan, big time. But it's just something that I've noticed.
Yeah, Christian's not too shabby, to say the least, man. I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's I like one. It's definitely one of those things. I'll say this from a personal experience that kind of like changed, like definitely got me thinking about it. Is I went to go see Wayne Bergeron, who's like one of the baddest cats on the planet, like on trumpet. Like he's lead trumpet in Gordon Goodwin and then like a recording monster. The guy's a robot. I mean, I went and saw Alan Vizzuti once, and Alan Vizzuti like said something about, he said, yeah, you know, I miss notes. I'm not Wayne Bergeron. So in case you're wondering, that's the standard where Wayne Bergeron's at. But he was doing a master class. And one of the things that he talked about was he was extremely anti-buzzing. And he kind of did that similar thing where he played, it's a little different with a trumpet, but he was playing and then he pulled it off and he was just blowing air through the mouthpiece. And so that just got me thinking, like, I think after that, I spent probably 2 weeks trying to play and rip off the horn and like, see if like, I don't know, man, I've been in circles and circles on it. Like if you were my student, I would probably give you my thoughts, but since you guys are just listening, yeah, don't even dig into what I'm saying. Go check out Christian's stuff, go check out Ben's stuff, go check them out all. And I think most importantly, and this is like a conclusion that we come to over and over again with these mouthpieces, is like humans are built different. You know, now the texture of your lip is different, the buildup of your muscles around your mouth are different, your jaw is different. My jaw is not the same jaw as Ben's jaw. And with that being said, like, things are going to work differently for everyone. So that's true for a lot of things in music, but I think it's super true for mouthpieces and like the process of like buzzing.
Yeah, man. Have you had any experience when it comes to teachers, whether or not telling you to buzz or not?
Yeah, I definitely have. I mean, I'll say that I've had people tell me to buzz at every level. I you know, when I was in middle school, high school, and then I've had college people do it, both trombone professors and band teachers. Although I will say one time I did have the person leading one of my like wind ensembles. He was talking about buzzing, and then afterwards he like wanted to have like a private conversation with me about whether or not I thought that buzzing was valid. So I don't know, like, if you're a teacher, like, do that, like, find people who you think are decent players or who you respect and make sure to like ask them what they think and stuff, and ask your colleagues, and, you know, just investigate. So yeah, I think that's kind of where I'm at with it. I think on that note, man, I think we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. All right, y'all, welcome back to the slideshow. All right, so I think on this end of it, we're going to get a little more into the hardware side of things, talk about materials and different parts of the mouthpiece and, you know, kind of what they all do and stuff like that. So, but the first thing I want to get into is just like kind of selecting a mouthpiece, you know, as a beginner or even kind of as a pro, but just kind of some tips and thoughts and stuff like that. For anyone who might be selecting a mouthpiece. I know that you have a lot of experience with this as a teacher, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely, Cody. So whenever I look at selecting a mouthpiece, a lot of times what I've noticed is it's really important not to stray too far away from what the norm is. Now, a lot of people might say, well, they have all their preferences and all that, but especially with beginners and younger players, it's important to really stick with what's being used at the moment. And I'll just go out there and say that most of my beginners start with a 6.5 AL, which is just like a box 6.5. Or to be honest, most of the instruments that are sold today, most beginner instruments actually come with that size mouthpiece. And there's a strong reason why those mouthpieces are suitable for beginners. I mean, they tend to be a little bit smaller. They're not oversized. It's a big deal to go pretty small to start with, but a 6.5 is a good medium size. It's not going to be too big for most beginners. And the big thing is that it is commonly used. And I just feel like that's a great, great start for beginners. Now, why we pick a 6.5, to be honest, it has to do with just how widely available it is. If you have some off-size mouthpiece, if you go way too big, it might hinder you from developing as a player. I think Cody, when I was talking to him, he mentioned he had a little bit more knowledge on this, but about like Joe Alessi playing on this massive-sized mouthpiece. Like, obviously, you wouldn't want a beginner to start off on something that big. I honestly just have always suggested my beginner start off a little bit small, but like a 6.5 is good. But most horns, especially if you buy like a beginner horn, are going to come with an appropriately sized mouthpiece, which is actually unpopular when you hear people say, hey, man, just use that mouthpiece that comes with your horn. To be honest, it should work for you. But in the case that you don't have a mouthpiece with your horn, a 6.5 is a good start for most applications. And I'm sure Cody has used a 6.5 for quite a while, and he could attest to that as well.
Yeah, man. I whenever I first started out, I just had like whatever came with the case, and then I was kind of instantly told like to move to something else, which was a 6.5 AL blessing, which I don't think is like a phenomenal mouthpiece. I don't know. I mean, I'm not to diss on blessing, but I think they're kind of entry level stuff in general. But I played on that for quite a while, actually, all the way up into college, like on my jazz side of things. I played the Schulke, but on the jazz side of things, I was still using a 6.5 for a long time, all the way up to my picket. And my picket is like essentially the same size. It's a 6M, which I think is slightly different than just a typical 6.5. But yeah, I mean, that feeds into that whole Curtis playing the same mouthpiece thing. It's just, that's definitely a factor. And yeah, definitely starting off, picking what your heroes play on may not be the way to go. Cause yeah, like Joe Alessi plays on like a massive mouthpiece, but he also has, you know, like an incredibly trained embouchure and everything. So it's, I'm pretty certain that his first trombone was not on a massive mouthpiece. He plays on a Griego, in case anyone's interested. He has like his own model Griego Alessi mouthpiece. And I say massive, I'm sure there's dudes playing bigger stuff out there. Just for a beginner, it would be really big. So yeah, I think that that's another thing too, is like bigger mouthpieces can be kind of difficult to play on in general, just like gaining control. And when you're just trying to get notes in the very beginning, that can be kind of a hard way to start off.
Yeah, absolutely. And and you know, for like the intermediate player, somebody who's actually played the horn for any amount of time, I mean, my suggestion for a 6.5 is really just a starting point. But for anybody who's played for any amount of time, if you're going to try to pick a mouthpiece, I honestly think you should shoot for comfort along with talking to whoever your teacher is. So probably somewhere in the middle. You might find a mouthpiece that's very comfortable that you play in front of your teacher and find out that, hey, I don't sound too good on that. At the same time, you might find a mouthpiece that you really like and also you sound really good on. And you'll hear from other people that say, hey, you sound good on that. You might end up finding that happy medium. A big thing is to try to change as few variables as possible at one time. So let's say if you're trying to change something, just like you're approaching a science experiment, you want to keep a lot of variables the same while only changing one thing at a time, be that rim diameter, cup diameter, or anything like that. I think that's a huge factor. And in order to do that, you're going to need to use your horn when you try these things out. So whatever you're going to be playing on, you need to be keeping the same whenever you're doing this. And I think that's a big factor. A lot of people will just try something way off the wall and might think that, well, they went bigger rim, bigger cup, and even like a deeper backbore, and not realize that, hey, they really only need to change one of those things. But because they just tried it all at one time, they might have missed even a better option for them.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing I thought I just had is like, if you're listening to this podcast right now and you got all the way into the second half of the show, first of all, probably learn something about mouthpieces, especially if you're like a brand new beginner. And you obviously have the whereabouts to like find trombone information on the internet. So, yeah, go ahead and ask around. I mean, ask in the trombone chat, people have opinions in there and they'll let you know, like, and don't just take one of them. Cause trust me, there'll be like 50 of them. There'll be like plenty of varying opinions from people who like really believe what they're talking about. Go ahead and ask in Reddit. And, there's like Facebook groups, there's mouthpiece Facebook groups, there's mouthpiece trading Facebook groups. There's so many Facebook groups now. There's probably like a mouthpiece group for like every kind of mouthpiece or something crazy. So yeah, like if you found this, like go ahead and like ask around, you know?
Yeah. I don't want to make it seem like my 6.5 AL theory is gospel. That's honestly something I do as a band director. You find yourself often having to streamline things. I have to suggest certain trombone models and certain mouthpieces. It makes things easier whenever you're dealing with the masses, but don't think that that's a solid rule. That's just something that I do in order to make things easier for my beginners, especially my parents who have to purchase these things. I can't just sit there and say, hey, if your kid's lips look like this, or if they have trouble with this, do that. No, I can't do that. So I have to pick kind of the one size fits most category with that. So that's why I take such a stance on that, is that's why I land on the conclusions I land on. So I'm in no means the leading authority on mouthpieces, but I just kind of go by what's going to work for most people.
Yeah. So I think we're kind of get into like the nitty-gritty of the metals and everything. And so just starting with materials, like the most common thing right off the bat is that mouthpieces are made of brass, and they either have like silver or gold plating. And it's funny because, like I said, like I didn't know a ton about mouthpieces before this. So like whenever I first looked up like what are mouthpieces like made of, just trying to find general explanation, it's like, oh, they're made out of brass. And I'm like, well, they're not colored like brass. And so yeah, like they're almost all like plated. And there's a couple of videos on the internet where you can watch people make different ones, like Dennis Wick goes through their whole process, and then a lot of people polish them by hand. I know Dennis Wick does that. So those are kind of the two big ones. And silver, like the silver plating is the most common that you see on most things. And then like on more expensive things or on like kind of nicer things, you'll start seeing gold plating. And the thing with gold plating is like, there's a lot of different opinions on it. Some people don't like it because it's a softer plating, obviously. And so like you can slide on it a little easier. So some people don't like it for slotting and stuff. I personally play on a gold rim and I really love that. And I like love the way it feels in my mouth, but like it's not for everyone. It is different. There is a change. You should check them both out. I know that Ben's not that crazy about gold personally. And then like the other one that I feel like is on the way after silver and gold, because I kind of want to do like a separate section for like alternative metals, and I don't feel like this quite fits in that yet, is like stainless steel. Like it's like a big thing that's coming up, and I know that like you spent some time with that, Ben.
Yeah, man. So back when I was playing the tuba, I spent some time using a stainless steel mouthpiece from a company, Giddings and Webster. I don't know if they're the only company still doing this. At the time they were. Apparently the machining for stainless steel is a little bit harder to machine than say brass or something like that. But stainless steel is a little bit slippery than silver. And it also helps with people who have metal allergies and things like that. I really did like the mouthpiece that I had got a hold of. But at the time it was, at the time it was the nicest tuba mouthpiece I had. And again, so Webster, I think that model was a Biamo. But my experience on the trombone was similar. I mean, they were a little bit more slippery. I had a satin finish one. It's kind of cool looking. I mean, it was different, but I think we're starting to see that stainless steel mouthpieces are kind of becoming more in the norm. At least from my experience, they have their place. Very similar to brass. The sizing is going to be a little bit more complex. You're going to have to go online and use some sizing comparisons. Actually, Cody and I have found a way to sideload an app from the company Pickett Brass that gave you a nice comparison of different sizes between trombone mouthpieces. But once you find the sizing that works for you, one of those Giddings mouthpieces is pretty nice, especially if you're allergic to something like brass or if your lips are reactive to silver. I do know some students who have had some trouble with brass, but usually that's remedied by just using a nicer silver-plated mouthpiece. Sometimes, I know Cody mentioned before about a mouthpiece turning black from one of his professors. Sometimes when a mouthpiece gets like that, you can start to get some reactions. I've had a student who was playing on an old mouthpiece that all they needed was to play on something fresh and it actually worked with their metal allergies. But if not, something like stainless steel works very well. And also, like I said, it's a pretty neat, different texture. I don't know how to explain it other than it's a little bit more slippery. And I guess it stays clean longer. We can get into lip gunk a little bit later, I guess. But my mouth tends to produce a lot of lip gunk, even though I use a brass mouthpiece now, just a straight silver-plated brass mouthpiece. I know when I played a stainless mouthpiece that didn't seem to accumulate as much.
Yeah. And for everyone listening, I just want you to know that Ben personally calls it mouth cheddar, which is super disgusting. I don't know why he's trying to be all, I call it lip gunk. I don't know why he's trying to be all professional. It's disgusting. Yeah. Gideon's and Webster, like if you want to like consider stainless steel or whatever, and you want to really, I'll just go and say over the top explanation of why to use it, why it's like most magical material of all, go to their page. They have like Gideon Webster has a whole mouthpiece page devoted to why to use stainless steel. And it is, they have a whole bunch of stuff in there. And I'll also say that like some of it may just be aesthetic. Like if you're really not feeling a big difference, like, you know, go for whatever you think looks cool. Or obviously with all of these situations, whatever you think sounds the best. But yeah, like Ben was kind of getting into like alternate metals there. And it's like, that's the big thing is like some people have brass allergies. And so there's some different options out there if you have this. I think a lot of beginners get stuck using some kind of like Darolin or acrylic plastic of some sort because that's like cheapest because alternatives can get expensive because they're not made as frequently. Like one of them that people use is titanium, which titanium is just an expensive metal, you know. I know that Elliot Mason has a brass allergy and he plays on a titanium mouthpiece, and I haven't really dug super far into this, but he just like started experiencing some like bumps around his mouth and some different issues, and he was having some like kind of lip like dryness, And so he kind of switched over. But yeah, I think it doesn't even necessarily have to be an allergy. Some people have more severe reactions, obviously, so they switch it up. It's good that there is options out there. You know, I mean, I don't know if you guys have heard Elliot Mason, but he sounds fantastic. I did see that he said that he prefers like brass, but I mean, the guy still sounds amazing. So don't think that like, oh, I have a brass allergy, I can't be like a great brass player. Like that's not true at all. Same thing with horns. There's like a bunch of different materials out there now as well. But yeah, when it comes to alternatives, I don't know. I started like dipping my toe in it, and then I was like, oh my goodness, there's so much more out here. There's wooden mouthpieces, which I remember a couple years ago, I was looking at this thing where this guy was making these weird cups that made like didgeridoo effects. And then he ended up never like actually producing them. Yeah, they make like legitimate wooden mouthpieces. A couple people have some. There's a French company, I can't off the top of my head think of the name. Oh yeah, Binturfa, I think I'm saying that right. Binturfa. I don't know if they're actually French. The cup and rim are wood, but the shank is still metal. But they're kind of an accepted one, and I know some other people are trying. And like, I think there's a larger discussion to be had about that. Another reason that people choose to do an alternative metal besides just like allergies is because of it's, as Ben pointed out, lip gunk. It's like a big thing where they're shedding a lot of like extra lip skin inside of their mouthpiece. And I've seen this vary for different people, and this could be a product of like how you're playing, or it could be a product of the metal and your lips reaction, or just your personal anatomy. But another reason could be feel. I know that a lot of the people who use something like Warbenite, for example, as I was talking about earlier, I don't know if Warbenite actually makes a trombone mouthpiece, but something like that is that like it's not going to get cold or super hot. Like the temperature is going to be more consistent, and then also it may keep your lips a lot more like firm on the mouthpiece. You're not going to slide around as much as you might with metal. But I think that there's like a pretty big world out there to look into.
Yeah, man. I'll say this, when it comes to alternative metals, you know, we actually had a buddy we went to college with who got on a lathe and decided to try to make a trombone mouthpiece out of aluminum. Now, this thing was thin, very, very, I guess, poorly made, but it was just this aluminum mouthpiece. And I remember playing on it, and it was pretty rough. You had a little bit more experience. I don't remember necessarily how it felt, but I do remember it not being that great, even though this guy spent some time on it. And
it was pretty bad. I mean, it's not, he made it in high school, so it's not like he was, you know, Monet or something, or Monet. I'm not sure. That's a top point of debate with trumpet players, but I'm not sure that he was like an expert a mouthpiece maker. He definitely wasn't, but yeah, it's pretty awful. The slotting was bad on it. The tone wasn't good on it. And it was really thin, so I think that was also kind of a factor, is that it had no density to it.
I will say, on the subject, though, of like these alternative metals or alternative materials, and just the thought of people even making their own mouthpiece, something that we're seeing with 3D printing and scanning is that this idea that you can change one aspect of your mouthpiece at a time. And that starting to see that some people are 3D printing themselves prototypes of mouthpieces and then sending this off to mouthpiece makers to actually make for them. And it's kind of a neat thing that we're seeing, because we're starting to see that your everyday player can now get the mouthpiece they want, and they can actually play on a model of it before they actually decide to order a full-on metal copy of it. And I'm kind of excited to see that becoming the norm as we get, you know, I guess more into the future.
Yeah, for sure, man. I mean, there's just so much out there. Like, just if you want to go digging into alternative stuff, like one cool thing I was showing Ben right before this is that Olds used to make mouthpieces with ivory rims, which obviously that's not a thing anymore, you know, and like this debate about whether or not that would be ethical. But yeah, it's, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff that's been done. So yeah, like looking at like different mouthpieces, there's a lot of different sizes out there. And like, can you like kind of go into like what the different sizes mean, Ben? Like as far as like what's the difference? Like when it says 51 or 6.5, like what are they like, you know, what they're usually referencing?
Absolutely. So I'm going to just go ahead and start off. Like most trombone players are going to run into two different sizing charts. Usually the big ones are going to be Bach sizing and Schilke sizing. Now, in the trombone range, at least to my knowledge, your Bach sizing is going to go from anywhere from 0 to 12, while your Schilke sizing will go from 47 or 48, off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you, to 61. And in the Schilke world, as you go higher in number, the mouthpiece gets bigger. In fact, a 62, I'm pretty sure, is like an F tuba mouthpiece. So they actually, Schilke almost has like the seamless transition from trombone to tuba mouthpiece, which I thought was kind of cool. While in the Bach world, the smaller the number, as you get to 0, the mouthpiece gets larger. You know, the most, one of the most common bass trombone mouthpiece sizes being 1.5, like a 1.5 G, that's going to be like, that's going to be a much larger mouthpiece than something like a 6.5 AL or even a 12 C. That's usually what you see. And I was even telling Cody about this. This naming convention or sizing convention is so popular that you even see it spilling over to other companies. You heard Cody mention he had a Blessing 6.5 AL. I actually pulled out a Blessing 12 C just before we came out here and recorded this podcast. So I know that uses that Bach naming convention. While at the same time, I also had a Yamaha 48, which follows more along the Schilke convention, which I thought was interesting. And even I've seen the same company, Yamaha, use both the Schilke sizing system and the Bach sizing system. I've seen a Yamaha 48 and a Yamaha 6.5 to make things a little bit more complicated. But either way, as long as you know that, and then as long as you know the number system, larger being bigger. And when I say bigger, I'm usually talking about just simply the rim diameter. That doesn't necessarily mean the cup depth is going to correlate. Normally, any difference in cup depth is going to also come along with any letter denominations. Like if you had a Schilke 51D, that D is going to mean it's going to have a deeper cup than a traditional 51, even though like the 51D is much more commonly used.
Yeah. Yeah. The number is like usually referenced like the inner rim diamenter of like, they usually refer to like a thousandth of an inch or like a fraction of a millimeter, which is why they're like that. Yeah. That's the thing is, yeah, the inner rim diameter, you got the rim and then you've got the cup. And the cups usually vary like in either a U or a V shape or something in between. And you can kind of look like, take like a Griego, it's got like a big U on it, or take like a Monet, which has got like a really hard V on it, or something like very in between, like a Stork, for example. So that's kind of like what those are usually referencing to in terms of that. And like, there's also kind of this thing with like adding weight to mouthpieces and what that does. What one thing is, like, I've noticed that trumpet players are really into adding weight. Like, I think these are possibly on the trombone, although I don't really see them, so maybe not. But, like, trumpet players will add weights onto the end of their, like, shank. And they'll also get weights for their valves, both on the top, and they'll add weight to the bottom sometimes. And, like, I think the general argument with weight is that it, by the way, I don't know the science of this, or even I don't ever agree or disagree with this, but the idea is that adding weight adds darkness and like it's easier to slot your notes. And then the counter argument is that it kills the overtones. So yeah, I think that's like a big thing with like the different sizes usually.
Yeah, I've actually seen something called mouthpiece sleeves on trombone, where these people had these sleeves, like these weights that went all the way around the mouthpiece. They would encompass a certain mouthpiece to add mass to it. And I think that whole philosophy is actually what spawns like mouthpieces such as like the Bach Megatone versus just Bach's traditional mouthpiece series and things like that. So you do see a lot on both sides with that.
Yeah, for sure. So I think that's going to kind of wrap it up for us. Like, what's your like overarching thought on all of this, man, with the mouthpieces, Ben?
Well, I'm sure you guys would see, just especially how we've talked, we are both pretty biased, and I probably have been a little bit stronger in my bias than I should be, but either way it comes down to it, I think it's super important that you guys play on a mouthpiece before you buy it, if you can, which there's actually, that's much harder said than done during a pandemic. But I think subscribing to one of these philosophies and really sticking with it and really seeing it through is going to be your best bet. And, you know, in my case, it was trying to change as little as possible and playing on the same mouthpiece. But some people, hey, changing might work. Talking to somebody who knows a little bit more than you about trombone, that's probably not me, but talking to somebody who knows a little bit more than you, or somebody who knows how you play, knows more about how you play and actually hears you play, they might give you a suggestion. They might hear a problem in your playing and say, hey, you should try something different. In general, that's probably going to be the best bit of advice you can get, is just hearing from somebody who's really far along in their trombone journey and taking that advice.
Yeah, man. Man, I hate to get to the end of the podcast and be like, hey, this podcast meant nothing, but that's honestly kind of how I feel. I feel like I spent so much time researching into this and like learning a ton about mouthpieces, because, and it was, it's like an ocean of stuff. Like, we didn't even get into, I mean, a billion topics about flat versus curved rims, like a wedge mouthpiece where it's like curved in. There's an entire world of thoughts and ideas out there. And all I can tell you is that stick to your guns. I mean, take advice from like people you respect, but at the same time, you know, human anatomy is different for all of us, as I've pointed out. And it's just this, your mouth is not the same as everyone else's. So, you know, try a lot, figure out what works for you, and then, you know, come up with your own philosophies. And hopefully something that I said or Ben said in all of this is something you can take away and either investigate or like kind of claim as your own. So it wasn't a complete waste of time. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's just a matter of like, you know, finding your own lane on this.
Absolutely, man. I think that's a huge part. Like, this is one of the few things that's going to, I don't want to say this is what's going to make you unique as a trombone player, because you might find yourself playing on the exact same thing. But with all these varying opinions and ideas out there, there are a lot of right decisions that you can make when it comes to a mouthpiece. And as long as it works for you, you should be okay.
All right. Our album recommendation of the week is Waiting to Continue, which is an album that Marshall Jilks just put out with his trio. It's got Yasushi Nakamura on bass and Clarence Penn on drums. Both of those dudes are super killing. I've been like really into their music. And yeah, I've already listened to it. It is super awesome. It came out during the COVID, November 14th, 2020. I don't think he was initially going to call it Waiting to Continue. I think that was a product of COVID renaming it, but he was going to make the album. And there's some YouTube videos of him playing with this trio online if you just want to check that out. But the album is super killing. He did some track layering, and Marshall is just one of the baddest dudes out there. And Marshall Jilks is how I think you say it. I think I saw a video with him saying it like that. Definitely not not what I've always thought. But as always, thanks for listening, and happy shedding.